This talk primarily, I'd say 70% comes from David Perlmutter's talk. David Perlmutter is the best integrative neurologist around. He's board certified in neurology and just about everything else as well. This is his website. Anybody who's interested in furthering your education about this subject, David Perlmutter is your guy. We're becoming more and more aware of these things called astrocytes. And if you can even see this a little bit, when you stain astrocytes, they look like star cells. And that's what astrocytes are. And they're a part of the blood-brain barrier that we hear about and the function in the brain itself. Oligodendrocytes. Again, if you can notice, there's very few branches. Oligodendrocytes just are basically cells with few branches, and that's the term. These are the glial cells. And one thing that's very confusing to doctors as well is microglial cells. And this is one of the big things we're going to talk about. These microglial cells are actually monocytes, macrophages present within the brain. About 12 to 15% of the brain is made up of these. That's where a lot of the information on Alzheimer's memory performance is coming from. Not from dysfunction of neurons, but from activation of the microglial cells, which aren't even neurons. And it's important because of the term glial. You would think this comes from the neuron because of its derivation. It doesn't. Microglial cells come from bone marrow precursors, monocytes, macrophages, basically. Okay? It's a very important understanding. When any part of your body is inflamed, your brain is inflamed. So in reviewing the hundreds and hundreds of articles that I did for this, okay, and I can't incorporate all those things in here. I try to make this as simple as possible. Every single person, for instance, with fatty liver disease has inflamed liver and subsequently poor memory, dysfunctional memory. So when we think about brain health, you have to think about the health of the whole organism, specifically because these things, microglial cells, part of your immune system, is what activating and causing dysfunction of the neurons. And anything that activates your microglial cells, we'll talk, I promise we'll get into this, okay? But that's why I put this slide up here, okay? Is this is where we're at, not just about neuronal dysfunction, it's about microglial function. And you think, man, why is he talking to a general audience about this? This sounds like all kinds of doctor stuff. Because in general, the doctors aren't very interested in this, and I'll talk to you about that why, the whys of that, okay? And so the general public has to become a little bit aware of these things, because any inflammation in your body will cause a deterioration of your mental function, anything, okay? And brain health is as important, your right toe health is as important for your brain health as your neurons are, okay? Very important take-home message. These activated microglial cells, I'm supposed to have a little question mark, anything that activates the microglial cells, inflammation, stress, will cause a whole range of dysfunction, all kinds of cytokines, inflammatory cytokines, mediators of inflammation, excitatory amino acids, glutamate especially, okay? When the microglial cell is in a nice, calm, resting state, it puts out these neurotrophic factors, especially brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which can cause you to grow new neurons, okay? So a nice, calm microglial cell, you're making more brain. Activated microglial cell, inflammation, okay? Here's a key concept. This, especially glutamate release. Glutamate is an excitatory neurotransmitter. Glutamate is not entirely evil, by the way. You need glutamate neurotransmission to make memories. But too much glutamate and you get activation through the same thing that comes through your equal and splendid that destroys your nerves, okay, to cause the neuronal dysfunction and neuron cell death. Now, this is one interesting part here when we talk later about alcohol. One of the best blockers of the NMDA receptor and glutamate-induced mitochondrial dysfunction and neuron death is alcohol. And we'll talk about alcohol in the brain in a way that you probably have never thought of it before. Probably. This is one of those highly stylized, you know, types of slides. Healthy neuron sitting in a healthy brain with healthy microglial cells and everything around doing nice things. Alzheimer's disease is known for two things. Now, it's known for a lot more than that, but two big fun things, okay. Amyloid plaques, which we'll talk about, and dysfunction within the nerve, the beating and things called, and dysfunction called neurofibrillary tangles. There's a lot of debate among the neuroscientists of the world, which one's more important, what does the worst, and all this other things, but there's clearly this change going on in the brain with a dysfunctional brain, okay? And you might think, what does this have to do with maximizing performance? We're going to emphasize using a disease model to just go away and tell you what's going wrong to help us know how we can tell what's going right. So, amyloid plaques, neurofibrillary tangles. And we're going to focus primarily on amyloid plaques tonight because, once again, this is a multi-week symposium I could do on this. I have to try to get into an hour and a half. So, if you have questions, please ask them, okay? I'd love to answer them. Alzheimer's disease, facts and figures, 5.3 million people have Alzheimer's, 9.9 million unpaid caregivers, $148 billion, sixth leading cause of death and growing, sixth leading cause of death, okay? New case every 70 seconds. Huh. Now, it's very important to understand, I think it was 1904, 1906, Lois Alzheimer defined on brain biopsy what Alzheimer's was and started recognizing neurofibrillary tangles and amyloid plaques. And at that time, it was extraordinarily rare, even among 80-year-olds, et cetera, to have this disease known as Alzheimer's disease. He was the one who described it. Brain biopsies and the techniques he used to develop the staining and find these things had been present for many, many decades, and nobody else had described this. Okay, so it's important for you to understand that. Is Alzheimer's a normal function of aging? No. By the age of 85, you now have a 50% chance of it. Is that a genetic disease or an environmental disease where in 100 years, the entire course has changed? It's not a genetic disease, people. Genetics code for your susceptibilities to things, okay? The rampant destruction of your brain. I can attribute to a lot of things. However, we got to understand it isn't just genes. Genes code for predispositions. So I know it's a lot because this is a big thing in especially in Western medicine. Well, we just want, oh, it's just genes, you know. You're just chubby because of your genes. You're just whatever because of your genes. It's not that, okay, 99%+ of the time. So, and we don't want people, the reason we do that is because nobody wants to be blamed for anything. I don't want to blame anybody for anything. We want people to be able to start taking responsibility for their health right now, okay? Are there changes everybody here can make right now that'll make a difference in terms of brain deterioration and subsequent decrease in microglial activation and improvement in brain function? Yes. All right. Now, seriously, if you come home with just a few of these concepts, you'll be ahead of most general doctors out there. Every now and then I choose my words carefully. You don't find that often, but you just saw it right there, okay? sorry. Alzheimer's disease-associated amyloid beta protein, those amyloid plaques, okay, is an antimicrobial peptide. Now, I'm not going to go through this whole slide, but basically they've shown that the beta amyloid actually is working in the brain to fight off many different types of organisms. So when you start accumulating this amyloid plaque in the brain, and that's been a target for many years for doctors to get rid of it, okay? And I really want you to hear that. Get rid of the stuff that's going in there without ever thinking about what it is, okay? And then see what happens, okay? Now we're finding, wait a minute, this stuff is accumulating for a reason, okay? Which is, once again, we're trying to get people to start thinking. Well, what is this beta amyloid doing? And as it turns out, it's an antimicrobial peptide. Recent studies have shown that the adaptive immune system, the one that helps you fight off colds and everything else like that, can't do a whole lot. Limited access to the brain, those astrocytes and oligodendrocytes, very tight blood-brain barrier protecting you from toxins and things, unfortunately, kind of protects you from your adaptive immune system too. So you have trouble fighting off infections in the brain. But the innate immune system has these antimicrobial peptides, which beta amyloid is just one of them. Antimicrobial peptides, called host defense peptides, they target many different organisms, fungi, protozoans, different gram-negative, gram-positive bacteria, potent immunomodulators that mediate cytokine release. So they basically function to cause an inflammatory response when your brain is fighting off something. Okay, it's a really important concept now. If the normal function of, that's amyloid beta, so beta amyloid, is to function as an antimicrobial peptide, then the absence of the peptide may result in increased vulnerability to infection. Now remember, every doctor and every trial up to this point has been focused on attacking beta amyloid and getting it out of your brain, okay, because it was bad, okay? So now we're saying, whoa, wait a minute, if we think, that might not be such a good idea. They finally found a drug, this doesn't matter what this drug right here, that caused the bodies to produce amyloid beta plaques, was able to successfully reduce amyloid beta amyloid plaquing in the brains of Alzheimer's patients, and what did we find? They worsened much more than the people on the placebo, because obviously everybody with Alzheimer's is going to be worsening, so they worsened more. Okay, so now this is very key for you people. Most of the times, our symptoms and our signs are a call for your attention. And what you've been taught for the last 100 years, really about the time that Dr. Alzheimer discovered this disease, is to fear your symptoms, to fear and run from them. Every pain, you need a drug. Every heartburn, you need an endoscopy because it could be cancer. And you've been trained this way for one reason. It's good business. Okay? We treat symptoms, in this case a sign, and we don't think about what we're doing. We don't look for whys anymore. So that's my biggest thing. Everybody probably here knows I'm big into Western medicine. During your honors medical program, I could go on and on about my scientific background. The biggest concern I have about Western medicine is the least scientific system of medicine I've studied, and I've studied most of them. Okay? It's meant to attack symptoms and signs, not to treat diseases. So we need to break people free from that kind of thinking, okay, and say, wow, I wonder why. So I try to train my patients. Every symptom is there as being one of your best guides. Thank your symptoms. Thank your headache. Thank your heartburn. Thank your... Because I didn't wish it for you. You didn't wish it for you. Nobody needs to blame you for it, okay? But think, huh, I wonder what this symptom or sign means. It's the first thing we need to start doing, because you don't have an antacid deficiency disorder. You don't have a Ritalin deficiency disorder, a Prozac deficiency disorder. They don't exist, okay? Nor do you have a need to just rid your body of things when they're accumulating. You need to figure out, I wonder why that's accumulating, right? Okay? So this is very important to understand, is most of the thinking from the neuroscientists and neurobiologists, the vast majority has been aimed at getting rid of beta amyloid, and it's been wrong from the get-go, the very genesis of why we're trying to get rid of it. It was accumulating, but it was accumulating for a reason. Now we need to find those reasons. Does this make sense? Okay. Human cathelicidin antimicrobial peptide, CAMP is also a name of a mediator of energy in the body, so I don't really like this acronym, but it's easier than saying this. So as a direct target, the vitamin D receptor is strongly upregulated in myeloid cells, those precursor cells, macrophages and things, all right, so especially directly related to that. Vitamin D receptors help your body with the appropriate development of antimicrobial peptides. As we will talk, I have many slides in here in vitamin D. If there's one thing I can get you over, is the inundation of information trying to get you to be diseased. Okay, Mitch, having you afraid of vitamin D is one of them. I have patients in my practice who have had low vitamin D for about 5 years now because they're still afraid of taking it, which is as silly a thing as you can have, but it's appropriately silly because they watch the news and they're afraid of taking something that's good for them because the main media is making sure you stay diseased. Okay. This has a great role in fighting infection. Vitamin D, and if you have our website, it's like the same thing that happened with melatonin and vitamin D. Vitamin D does help. First of all, it's not a vitamin. It's vital amine. It's not a vitamin. Vitamin D is a steroid hormone your body produces in response to sun. Okay? And it does help. This tiny fraction of what it does is help your bones. And if you have acute, severe deficiency, you will develop a childhood condition called rickets. There's no question about that. That role is about 2% of what vitamin D does in your body. And the levels you need to protect your bones is this tiny amount, that 400, 600 units. The levels that you need to get the effects and help protect your brain are thousands of units higher, and unless you're running around naked around the equator, which I highly suggest, but you have to keep doing it, you're not going to get there, okay? So there you go. So one of the take-home messages, vitamin D protects your brain. It protects your pancreas. It protects your heart. It does it does so many powerfully good things for you, but the media, and this is part of the questioning thing, the media keeps on telling you not to take it, even though everybody in science knows it does more. Everybody, okay? But the media still tells you, don't take it, be afraid of it. Doctors today still, I hope you don't mind, I mean, they're, you know, I could give you story after story of, oh my God, you're taking vitamin D, you know. You can eat as much diet soda, you can be cranking away on crank, and they won't care, okay? But you take vitamin D, your doctor will freak out on you. It's amazing, okay? So, we're going to need to figure out where to poke that brain. So, I know I'm just getting you guys going, and I know I've got to get through a lot. So, questions so far? Yes? Oh. Whoa, oops, sorry. Whoa, that was a good one. Try it, Hobbs. Just poke his brain right here with my finger. Trust me, when you're a doctor, doing stuff like that is really kind of cool. Okay, so I've been in brain and things with neurosurgeons, and we do like doing stuff like this. So that's why this stuff is so good. Gary Larson, Far Side, go back, get his old stuff. Yes, I'm typing his slides. He's no longer with us, but, you know, Gary Larson, Far Side, greatest comic, cartoon writer ever. So, now, the role of neurodegenerative diseases. And I'll show slide after slide. I am going to try to overwhelm you with information. So if you don't leave here overwhelmed, I haven't done my job. Okay. Now, that being stated, that if you have questions, ask. Yes. And the slides are on the website. The audio is going to be on the website. If you need to go home and you don't have enough melatonin, which is another great article recently, by the way, let's go to another thing. Melatonin. About 2 or 3% of what melatonin does in your brain has to do with the sleep function. Everybody here thinks melatonin has to do with sleep. You're right, and you're 98% wrong, okay? Which means melatonin type 1 and type 2 receptors function everywhere in your body. It's one of the most powerful anti-cancer agents of all time, okay? And it goes on and on and on about the functions of melatonin in the body. Yes? The question relates to melatonin dosages and nightmares. Most of the times, if people take melatonin and it induces nightmares, it's probably because you're actually already short on REM sleep. Most of the time, if you stay on that dosage, the nightmares will go away. That's REM rebound. Okay, REM sleep is the deeper sleep where you're actually getting dream sleep, rapid eye movement. Okay, so that, and I'm not saying that's, you know, that's the joke I give to people. This is, you know, this will give you more vivid dreaming, and if you have good dreams, you're going to like this. And if you don't, then you won't. But most of the times, that goes away. I really did have somebody who's like, man, I was getting the best dreams, but now they're going away. I go, sorry, dude, that's going to keep going away. So, you know, so vivid dreaming is a part of melatonin. And a key, and there's articles on the website, but, you know, that reference all these things. But once again, we learn this tiny little fraction of what something does, and that's what we get stuck on. And we try to get people learning past old knowledge, okay? Knowledge is a prison of past conditioning. So if you hold on too highly to knowledge, you are a prisoner, okay? And because most of what you think is true will be proven wrong, okay? So get used to it. Keep reading, doing other things, but don't attach to yourself too much to that knowledge that we hold so deified in our culture. These are the roles of certain infection diseases in different neurodegenerative diseases. I'm going to focus on a few, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and multiple sclerosis, okay? And the synergistic role of vitamin D deficiency. I mean, you can call this insufficiency. True deficiency, you probably would call rickets, okay? What I'm talking about is an insufficiency because you won't die immediately or your bones won't fall apart or something. But those terminologies, I think, because it's really been shown in the general public, if you don't scare them about something or do, you know, just give you a brief aside, and for doctors, there used to be, for women with osteoporosis, they used to be listed as mild, moderate, and severe, okay? They took away all those categories because doctors didn't give you enough drugs if it was mild osteoporosis. It was tougher to convince you to take drugs, so they took all the categories away. And, of course, there is such a thing as mild and moderate and severe. They just took the categories away, so we would give you more drugs. So if we don't make something sound disastrous. Vitamin D deficiency, you know, I'm just going to suck it right out of my body. You probably won't take it. And that's been my experience. I have patients years after year after year, their vitamin D levels are deficient. Okay, because they buy into the public. Obviously, I'm telling them to take it. But, you know, who am I and who's all this great data and everything else? It's all there. They're just willing to listen to forces that kind of keep them afraid. Think about that. So, seropositivity of herpes simplex virus antibodies and risk of Alzheimer's disease, population-based cohort study. Everything I'm going to give you is peer-reviewed science, and I'll tell you when it's not, okay? But the articles come from journals like the Archives of Neurology and Neurology itself, the Journal of Neurology. Reactivation of herpes simplex virus, seropositivity just means reactivation of herpes simplex virus 1, okay, is strongly associated with inflammatory changes and Alzheimer's disease. Okay, so this is just an association between herpes simplex 1, which is a virus that catches cold sores. This has nothing to do with sex, people. Okay, this is due to this whole group of viruses that love to live in your body and keep reactivating. Herpes simplex virus 1, herpes simplex virus 2, varicella zoster virus. Who here knows which that one is? Shingles, very good. Chicken pox that causes shingles. Can that come back later in life? Yeah, okay. Cytomegalovirus, Epstein-Barr virus, human herpes virus 6. These are all a whole group of viruses that like to take up residence in you and keep reactivating and are a huge source of disease. Okay, they're part of the picture. Okay, herpes simplex 1 encephalitis, which is known to account, had the direct distribution associated with the loss that we see of neurons in Alzheimer's disease. So that's quite interesting. High levels of antibodies associated with it. Intrathecal immune system, we can find immune response within the cerebral spinal fluid itself, okay? And we can directly, polymerase chain reaction, we can directly grow this stuff out of Alzheimer's brains and we can't do it out of other ones. Interesting. What this means is that herpes simplex virus 1 is strongly associated with Alzheimer's disease. It's an infection. Remember the beta amyloid plaque. Let's tie it back again, okay? That plaquing is a response to infection. When you get rid of the infection, what will happen? Get rid of the beta amyloid, your body's response to fighting the infection. The infection gets worse, your brain dysfunction gets worse. Ah, that makes sense. So we don't want to just get rid of beta amyloid, we want to get rid of the reason why the beta amyloid is accumulating. Right? Okay. And nobody's doubting that this plaquing is causing dysfunction, collateral damage in the brain, by the way. I'm not saying it doesn't. We're not going, yahoo, there's beta amyloid in my brain. Okay. We're saying, huh, that's a sign of another problem. Here's another one. Here's another cool little piece of information. We've known that that genetic apoprotein E4 is an allele. Sorry, it's a genetic apoproteins line your lipids and direct LDLs and VLDLs to areas of repair, okay? Apoprotein E4 is associated with Alzheimer's disease. As it turns out, people who have ApoE4 have much more trouble fighting off herpes simplex virus 1. The linkage between this gene is this gene plus a certain environmental trigger, herpes simplex 1, cold sores, okay? Leads to more reactivations and more severe reactivations. That's how that is linked. So we find this genetic link, and it's because of an immune response gene. Okay? Furthermore, it's not that easy. So as Dr. Ford has been saying, that all Alzheimer's disease is just a herpes simplex 1 infection. That would be reductionistic idiocy. Okay? So once again, everybody's looking for a magic bullet. Get rid of beta amyloid. Get rid of herpes simplex 1. It's never that easy. Okay? Everything you're facing in your life is multifactorial. And when I say it that way, on an outpatient basis, when you're seeing a doctor, if you present with any kind of syndrome, there's many reasons. And that's what I'm trying to get you across in here. I'm not trying to blame everything on herpes simplex 1, but that's one other key thing. That virus can reactivate and cause destruction in every brain. Bummer. Okay? What can we do about that? We'll get into that. But that's not all. There's so many other things associated with Alzheimer's disease. And everybody's looking for that one thing causing Alzheimer's disease, and it's not. It's aging of the brain. And this is one factor in some people. And I know that's not satisfying. It doesn't get you on the TV. It doesn't make a Dr. Oz moment. Okay? Sorry. I was sent this great cartoon by someone. And it was, this great. This doctor comes in the office and the patient's there and the doctor has all his degrees on the wall and there's this huge thing up that says, thank you for not mentioning Dr. Oz. I love that. I really want to get the actual original artwork and put it up in my office. There's always somebody around like that that's, you know, supposedly intelligent. And so he is intelligent and he has some good pieces of advice and he has some very dangerous pieces of advice. Chlamydia, culture of this organism from brain tissue homages, breaking it down, okay, you can find in a higher rate in Alzheimer's disease patients, okay. Astrocytes, microglia, neurons all served as host cells for chlamydia pneumonia. And this is funny because somebody was asking this. This is all about sexually transmitted things. No, herpes simplex 1 is not sexually transmitted. Chlamydia pneumonia is a respiratory infection. Nothing to do with that chlamydia that causes the other sexually transmitted things. So there are some things about guys only having enough blood flow for one brain at a time. But this has nothing to do with sexually transmitted things. This has to do with certain infections that get into your brain that your adaptive immune system is having trouble fighting off. Can't get in there. Your innate immune system is trying hard to get rid of these organisms, but it's very tough to get rid of them. Especially when so many other environmental factors are going on that make the inflammatory response that much worse and cause so much more collateral damage. So, chlamydia pneumonia, and this is percent of brains found that you can find in Alzheimer's, up to 70%, you can actually grow chlamydia from the brain. Okay? And a small percentage, a couple of percentage, in non-Alzheimer's patients. So it's not 100%, but you can see this dramatic difference. Okay? Now, hopefully I'm not being confusing. We're saying that different infections can trigger an inflammatory response, especially these microglial cells in there that get activated throughout a whole bunch of mediators. If you go back to the earlier slides, a ton of mediators that can lead to a pro-inflammatory response in the brain and dysfunction. Furthermore, if you remember what I talked about too, any inflammation in the body can cause reactivation. So we all know that herpes simplex 1 can reactivate if you get a common cold. You get a common cold, it can reactivate in your brain. You can get reactivated herpes simplex 1 here too. Bummer. Okay. 1 second. Thank you. Furthermore, we all know stress. Stress. Oh, my herpes is back. Stress. Stress. This is another mechanism by stress-related loss of immune control can lead to inflammation, herpes simplex virus reactivation, and brain dysfunction. Yes. But yes, and let me repeat the question and kind of put a context to it. Your adaptive immune system helps your body fight off chlamydia and pneumonia and prevents you from getting it, hopefully even once you get exposed to the organism, even getting an infection, okay? Furthermore, if you do get chlamydia and pneumonia, and it does cause pneumonia and you fight it off with antibiotics, et cetera, then what you can do is fight it off using your adaptive immune system. But once it gets into your brain, it's very tough to get rid of. It's an intracellular organism. It's a whole bunch of reasons why it's difficult for your innate immune system to fight it off. It's not very well adapted to fighting these things off. And so, yes, it means it's in a latent state. It's not, it's reactivating probably through the same reasons that herpes simplex 1 is reactivating, okay? So it can reactivate a little bit, cause some inflammation destruction, go down. Inflammation destruction, go down. Okay, and it doesn't mean you have chlamydia and pneumonia growing in your lungs. Does that answer your question? Good. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes.
Is that right?
Dramatically. It's an almost entirely environmental. Yes. There's multiple environmental factors. Now, these kinds of infections and why they reactivate so much and why our immune system is so dysfunctional, like vitamin D deficiency and other things like that, over a length of time, is a large part of that. Yes. Okay. Yes. And so it's absolutely and that's why this is so important. As our population ages, as we well know, this is one of the main concerns I have for my patients is how do I keep my brain? Okay. And what the mystification, the disease labeling of things is the problem because we wait until we're diseased until we treat something. So I used to have this place, one of the older businesses, Natural Balance Wellness Center. And it was never a wellness center. It was still a Natural Balance Disease Treatment Center would have been the better name because nobody comes in for wellness. Okay. You guys always wait until you're diseased. And that's what gets you motivated. And I'm trying to tell you, there's pre-disease going on way early, and you better identify it now. Most people go, oh, don't feel so bad. You're not diabetic yet. So, you know, go home and have a cookie, okay? And we're going to show all these things with blood sugar, and even little levels of increases in blood sugar dramatically causes brain atrophy long before diabetes, okay? And I could go on and on for a whole bunch of other things as well. The vitamin D levels necessary to protect your brain are so much higher than you're probably ever going to get. So measure your darn vitamin D level, and however much amount... Take-home message, however much of a vitamin D you need to take, I don't care if it's 20,000, 40,000, or 2,000, to get your level between 70 to 90 on the blood test, that's where you need to be. And if I ever could make an argument, it's for more, not less. If you're ever afraid of vitamin D, you are a product of past conditioning, of people trying to make you into the dinosauric event that other extinct members of our species have become. Okay? Vitamin D in the brain, membrane-bound antioxidant, enhances neurotrophins, those are the brain-derived neurotrophic factors, increases hippocampal density, at least in rodents, suppresses inflammatory cytokines, acts as a direct antimicrobial itself. These are the roles of vitamin D. A lot more than bones, isn't it? Okay? It's more than bones. Hopefully this is one of those aha moments. This is very little in terms of even very simple amounts of vitamin D intake, and the risk of dementia and Alzheimer's. Now, when you have dementia over here, remember there's vascular dementias, Parkinson's dementias, Binswanger's, and goes on and on about many different types of dementias. So, but vascular dementia, meaning problems with blood flow, okay, and Alzheimer's are the biggest ones by far. And vitamin D deficiency is associated with all of them. So please be afraid of vitamin D. I'm sorry if I'm hammering this one home, but do you see how much effort out there is made to keep you from taking something that's so profoundly beneficial for you? Yes? Vitamin D is one of the greatest things you can do to prevent a heart attack. So are you hearing that as a direct product of which news station? Sorry, I guess which one. But that's the whole kind of thing. Vitamin D is one of the best things that help in preventing a heart attack that exists. Okay, the thing that causes heart attacks is the things everybody's trying to sell you. So, I bet we were getting that. What was shown, and at the same time the Institute of Medicine says, don't take vitamin D, they said, but keep on taking calcium. Okay, at that time, calcium supplements. Women taking calcium supplements, 1 out of 77 women who listens to their doctor and takes calcium supplements will get a heart attack or stroke. And that's what's causing the heart attacks and strokes is calcium supplementation. Okay, but the Institute of Medicine said, keep on taking it. Because the same drug companies that make calcium citrate, caltrate, and all those things, those are drug companies that make those, make the drugs to treat heart disease. Come to your own conclusions. But it's the calcium that causes heart attacks and strokes, not the vitamin D. Vitamin D prevents them. Yes? Hold on just a second. Let me cover that. Because I'm going to cover just a second, because I'm going to cover that very own mythology that's out there, okay, so about D and hypercalcemia. The primary toxicity, supposedly, of vitamin D is causing hypercalcemia. Let's look at the evidence, okay? Before we get to that, multiple sclerosis, monozygotic twins, identical twins, okay? And we know from this alone, the discrepancy, it doesn't 100% of monozygotic twins don't get it, that there's environmental factors. It isn't purely a genetic disorder, okay? That's what this means, okay? And we know because there's these weird bands of immunoglobulins in the spinal fluid that there's something going on, but we don't know exactly what it is. And most chronic inflammatory disorders are infectious. I'll get to this. Then we look at UV radiation. This is just a wonderful study done in France and looking at what the highest levels of UV radiation are and the rates per, this is latitude, this is the exposure, longitude, okay? And so the areas with the highest prevalence of ultraviolet radiation, the rates per 100,000 for multiple sclerosis. And look down here in the 50s, and it goes in through here, 60s and 70s, 80s, 90s, and 100s. Direct correlation of multiple sclerosis and vitamin D deficiency and sun exposure deficiency. Okay? And this is a very important thing for you to hear, is in a further, I can't put every one of these slides up there, or you guys would be here for all night. And so, but they've actually shown that the people with the highest vitamin D levels and the highest sun exposure have the lowest rate of multiple sclerosis. And because there's some people with high sun exposure and low D, okay, and they have an intermediate risk, or high D because they take it and low sun exposure, okay, intermediate risk. Okay, the highest risk, of course, is low D and low sun exposure. But it's an important thing. There's some beneficial effect to sun exposure that goes way beyond vitamin D. Okay, it's not just vitamin D that you get from the sun. And that's why I tell people in the past, you know, We are told, oh my, you know, people worship the sun. And then currently, everybody's afraid of it. A complete mythology, okay? And choose somewhere in the middle, okay? We don't want people sunburning, but the way we get exposed to sun in our society, which is lots of burns as a teenager and then avoiding sun as you get older, is the perfect way to die from skin cancer. Yes?
Sunscreen.
And again, most of you saw those things. Most of the sunscreens are aimed at women, and you're getting products that have tons of xenoestrogens and things, higher rates of infertility, PMS, all these other things, no rate and decrease of causing skin cancer whatsoever. So there's titanium dioxide, silicon dioxide is a decent topical, the white stuff the surfers put on. That's the decent form. But any woman, this is another take-home message. As you know, most of the fear in the world is targeted at women, because you guys buy more than we do. Okay, it's true. And all that stuff, if you put anything on your body, you're exposing, most of the toxins you're exposed to are probably the stuff you're putting on your body, even more so than what you're ingesting. Guys, we don't put as much of that stuff on, but there's more of that manscaping going on, so we're trying to catch up. sorry. So think of your body, put everything organic on your body as well. The sunscreen mythology is another way of promoting a product and causing disease, which is what we want in our society. Say that again?
Sunscreens have nanoparticles.
Sunscreens have all kinds of different particles and nano and otherwise that you can absorb. Your skin is a great absorbent of nutrients, so you can get nutrients in there too, okay? But also chemicals and all the parabens and all the things we're supposed to be decreasing. So the sunscreen mythology has been a great way of promoting disease in our society. Nobody's asking you to get sunburned, so let's follow common sense. Okay, sunburns aren't good for anybody. I would use as much of a natural sunscreen as possible to prevent sunburns. But anything else other than that is completely unsupported by any evidence whatsoever. And I cannot emphasize none. Okay, and it's only out there for one reason. I'll let you figure that out. Mm-hmm. Okay, so once again, so I'll get to the calcium thing in just a second and the vitamin D along with that, okay? So I promise we'll get to there. So vitamin D strongly associated deficiency with multiple sclerosis, another neurodegenerative disease. This is once again looking at women and men, their rates of multiple sclerosis, and this is how much light you're getting exposed to, direct linear correlation, more sun, less multiple sclerosis. We certainly don't want that. Now, going into this things, they're going up to 280,000 units a week, so 40,000 units a day. And all throughout these trials, there's multiple trials now on using vitamin D for the treatment of multiple sclerosis, okay? This is what happens to your serum calcium. And the answer is nothing. I have people with levels who've accidentally taken too much D, hundreds and hundreds high, 180s, 216s. I've never seen a high serum calcium yet. And most of those people actually don't even want to get off vitamin D because they think they feel better. Okay, and they don't even know their levels are that high. Now, am I promoting people getting levels up into the 200s? No. On a primary care basis, that's not an intelligent thing to do. Treating multiple sclerosis, it's the safest thing you can do. So does vitamin D cause hypercalcemia? It's reported everywhere, and you can surely take enough of it. Vitamin D2, especially the kind that doctors can, causes much more hypercalcemia than D3. Simplest distinction, D3 is what humans use. D2 is great for fungi. So if your doctor prescribes you fungi vitamin D, leave. Okay? Seriously. Okay? D2 has been shown not to be as effective as D3 and promoting any form of health. And furthermore, your body responds. That antimicrobial peptide responds specifically to 1,25-dihydroxy-D3. 1,25-dihydroxy-D2 has no effect on these antimicrobial peptides. The main things that you need come from the D3, which is what us humans make. Okay? So, does vitamin D cause hypercalcemia? It's reported everywhere. It can occur. Don't be crazy and foolish. If you start taking 40,000 units a day, please, you know, monitor with your doctor. Some people need that much to get their levels appropriate. It's very rare. Okay. The average person amount of vitamin D to get their, again, for vitamin D adequacy, 4,000 to 12,000 units, somewhere in there. Most people end up around there. All right. Back to the calcium part of it. The key is, and why does calcium cause heart attacks and stroke? Because, remember, this is a whole other set of lectures, okay? So, because calcium is a member of a mineral family, and once you give one member at far excess of its family members, you will always cause an imbalance, okay? So why does Alpha tocopherol, one form of vitamin E taken in excess cause disease because you hinder the absorption and the utilization of other forms of vitamin E. Okay? Why don't you just take folic acid? Because if you take folic acid on its own, you can deplete B12. And if you just take calcium, you can further deplete magnesium, leading to heart attack and stroke. So if you take a balanced multi-mineral, that makes nutritional sense. So any doctor who prescribes just calcium alone doesn't understand nutrition and is causing, and I can't emphasize, there's more evidence for that causing heart attacks than the statin they're giving you preventing it. Much more evidence. Think about it. So does that answer the questions? So vitamin D, the mythology in terms of it causing disease and things like that, always big common sense. If you say I take vitamin D and I feel horrible, I wouldn't take it. If you ate blueberries and it felt horrible, I wouldn't eat them, okay? So use common sense, of course. But being afraid of vitamin D is perpetrated upon you. Yes?
No, I mean,
it's most of it is sourced from the fish oils. That's where most people get it from. You aren't going to ingest vitamin D3 because it's, first of all, not a vitamin. It's not a nutrient unless you're eating seal livers, which, you know, that would be politically incorrect. Bashing baby seals and stuff, it's always considered bad. So don't be afraid of vitamin D. Be afraid of what's, and think about this. This is the thing, is I'm trying to get people to actually start critically thinking again. I wonder why I'm being told something that goes against all of scientific evidence. Interesting. This goes into multiple sclerosis. Vitamin D currently is the best treatment for multiple sclerosis that exists in terms of lack of toxicity and improvement in preventing and causing a decrease in relapses, a 41% decrease in relapses. And that's a very important thing to see. The ABC drugs, the classic ones used to treat MS, do not give this kind of a treatment response rate. And furthermore, no toxicity was seen at vitamin D at dosed up to 40,000 units a day. Interesting. Going right into this, because is the vitamin D just working? Because it's an antimicrobial peptide. Hold your horses. It goes into so much more than that. Back to the whole thing. Vitamin D, one of the best ways of preventing heart attacks that exists. Why? Because vitamin D is one of the best things, and there was just a recent trial that was awesome on vitamin D leading to almost a 50% reduction in metabolic syndrome. Just on its own. Just on its own. Okay? Because it helps your body lower blood sugar. Okay, this is fasting. This is glucose at different hours, 60 minutes, 90 minutes, and 120 minutes. All these things improve just with vitamin D. Vitamin D not only facilitates the biosynthetic capacity of beta cells, makes them work better, make more insulin, but converts proinsulin into insulin. Okay, 25-hydroxy D improves beta cell function and decreases insulin resistance. So that's why I get such a fascinating by anybody saying D being associated with heart attacks, because it's probably in the most models, one of the best ways you can do to prevent a heart attack is take vitamin D. Yes? 1,000 units of D is almost never to get enough. The answer to the question, once again, is measure levels and get your level between 70 to 90. Okay, and if your level isn't 70, you're not at an optimal level. Are you going to die if your level is 30? Well, eventually, one day, but, you know, is it going to kill you? No. It's going to lead to more rapid deterioration of your brain, greater risk of heart attack, and greater risk of about every disease known to man. And you can do that if you want. So, provitamin D, this formed in the skin, goes to the liver, goes to the kidney, makes the active form. This active form helps with your immune response, especially in the brain. That's how it works. It's not just about the bones. Vitamin D and the risk of Parkinson's disease. Oh, what relationship could that have? Well, it has this one, okay? Top quartile and all the rest, risk quartile 4 had about 33%. So you could prevent 2/3 of all Parkinson's disease by taking enough vitamin D. Okay, all neurodegenerative diseases have a primarily infectious or toxic role like Parkinson's disease primarily. Vitamin D helps with your efflux of toxins out of the brain too, by the way. So not one of its other mechanisms of action. Yes? Vitamin D, there's current on the treatment of vitamin D and on Alzheimer's, of course. Sorry, but start early. Vitamin D can prevent up to 90% of type 1 diabetes. And started at the infant stage. And there's trials going back into the 60s using 10,000 units a day in infants. Yes, less than 6 pounds. Okay, so what's that? I do not know about that disease in terms of its use in that. However, it can prevent autoimmune disease, it can prevent multiple sclerosis, it can help with immune system function, and it's been used for decades and decades in forward-thinking countries, meaning not here, okay, in the treatment and prevention of disease with ultimate safety at high dose in babies, but we're afraid of it here. It's not a drug. It's very fascinating. And this is, like I said, most of the times, I mean, many people I can help them, you know, lead them to the water, but can you make them drink? Okay, so that's, I think we all know that. Can you make them drink? You can get them there. So, you know, I know as far as this goes, what I'm talking about right now is, I try different styles and different types of talks and things like that, but why am I doing the talk this way? Because am I trying to get people to think critically? Yes. Critical thinking takes a certain edge, okay, and it makes you have to get a little motivated to start using your brain again, okay, because you can't accept what's said on the TV. I don't ask you to accept anything I say is true. I really don't, okay. However, I've researched more, and I don't come in, and this is the biggest difference between me, I don't have any agenda against any medicine in the world or any supplement in the world or for one. I just wrote an expose on grapefruit seed extract and why not to use that, okay. So my main thing is the isness of the world, okay, seeing what is, okay, and this is what is, and it really does, when I said integrative medicine, it really does surprise me, what is it that's keeping everybody afraid of vitamin D? That's like a fascinating question, okay, and that's just one simple subject, it's only one tiny part of the talk. Here's a wonderful study looking at obesity, okay, it took people age 40 to 45 years, between this 64 and 73, 27-year follow-up, risk of Alzheimer's comparing the lowest, that's the least amount of fat to most amount of fat, about a threefold increased risk of Alzheimer's. So is obesity associated with this? And the answer is yes, obesity directly correlates with brain dysfunction. So wait a minute, what about herpes simplex 1? What about chlamydia? What about D deficiency? It's a multifactorial process with different things going on in different people. Is that confusing? Well, yes and no. It's just the way it is, okay? I always tell people I didn't devise this system. It's just kind of the way we are, okay? So, but it goes back to magic bullet medicine. You're never going to cure Alzheimer's just with vitamin D. I'm not even remotely pretending on that, okay? Vitamin D and some wine, sure. Just kidding, a little. So, however, can we treat it all by treating obesity? Well, no, we can't treat all of it. But a certain amount of people where the pro-inflammatory, obesity, insulin resistance, fatty liver, inflamed brain. It's a very simple, easy, from my perspective, way of thinking of things. Oh, I have obesity, that huge mass of cells, okay? I didn't show you this. And furthermore, and this is one of my favorite jokes is, you know, you think with all that obesity around and things like that, you have greater solar panels and you get more D, right? You know, more D. No, it doesn't work that way for some reason. The greater solar panels with us obese people, no, you don't get higher. You have a decreased amount of vitamin D. There's utilization issues and it goes on and on. And I'm not saying the only way that obesity causes Alzheimer's, but vitamin D deficiency is one of the mechanisms by which obesity leads to Alzheimer's. And it's always more complicated than just saying, oh, it's insulin resistance, because that's the first thing I said. But I did that intentionally because I knew the slide was coming up, obviously. So it's to point out, wow, every time we think we know how something is working, we're usually not quite there yet. There's something else going on. All right, this is a complicated slide, but I just want you to hang with me. Any acute systemic inflammatory event, which was found in around a half of these subjects, okay, which led to an increase in this TNF-alpha, almost everybody's heard about it if you watch TV, okay, was associated with a significant cognitive decline over a six-month period, especially those who had a higher level of TNF-alpha, also associated with fourfold rate increased rate of cognitive disease. These are people who already have Alzheimer's. So subjects who had low levels of TNF-alpha had almost no decline over the six-month period. Hang in there. Both acute and chronic systemic inflammation associated with increases in this one marker, and it's much more complicated than that, is associated with increase in cognitive decline in Alzheimer's. We're going to do one more slide before we explain. In summary, we propose that during events such as stress, peripheral infection, pneumonias, autoimmune disease, okay, HSV-1 reactivates, as in the peripheral nervous system, cold sores, causing an acute but localized infection, a mild variant of encephalitis, greater damage, and especially in APOE4 carriers and eventually Alzheimer's disease. Okay, now, so once you have ongoing inflammation, whether through obesity, chronic infection, any number of other markers, which we'll talk about, low vitamin D levels, some insult happens to your body. You get a pneumonia, a bad urine infection, something else. That inflammation has been strongly correlated with a more rapid decline in the Alzheimer's disease. Is that just because of reactivation of herpes simplex 1? Possibly. It's probably more than that, though. Okay? This is one of the theories that are out there. The functional medicine model, Perlmutter, myself, functional anti-aging regenerative medicine. People who do functional medicine think. Okay? So what's the main thing to look at that. That's what you do. You're thinking about what's going on. And this is the actual model, microglial activation, cytokines, stress, mitochondrial failures, neuronal death, and decreased acetylcholine. What are all the drugs that we do now to treat Alzheimer's? Treat here. The symptom, the end stage, and things like that. That's why it's woefully ineffective and actually can't work. That's the most important thing to understand. You've missed all these other phases of the disease, and if you don't treat this, this cannot work. Can this lead to some temporary benefits in some people? Yes. Okay. But the basic thing to understand is this is what's happening, and this is what we're giving people. That's the best science has to do over the last 100 years. Fascinating. So, we need better antioxidants, anti-inflammatory agents to prevent the this. And this is in the Archives of Neurology in 2007. So this is even recognized in the neurologist literature. Breakthroughs in science take still about 15 to 25 years to make it to clinical medicine. Okay, and we don't think that's probably reasonable anymore. In terms of, I don't think it should be, but back in the olden days when you had to go back to the library and go through all the, what was a med thing that you used to look at? I can't remember. All these things are available to us right now. So why does it take so long for the doctor to get it into clinical practice? Time, insurance, it's covered by my insurance, it's not covered by my insurance. Could lysine supplementation prevent Alzheimer's dementia? And then this is a little bit about HSV1 requiring arginine for replication. This goes into that. A lot of guys are taking arginine for their erections, but it might be causing their brain to deteriorate. They'll probably keep taking arginine, mind you. sorry. But lysine does inhibit HSV1 replication. And I'm not saying arginine is evil, by the way. Okay, there still needs more. There actually are 6 randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trials showing a dosage of lysine like this can reduce herpes simplex 1 outbreaks. So that's much we know. Can long-term lysine supplementation prevent Alzheimer's or decrease or delay the course of it? Possibly. That science isn't there yet. So please, don't leave here saying we just found a cure for Alzheimer's, because I'm not saying that. But can you make an argument if you have recurring HSV-1, herpes simplex 1, sorry, cold sores, okay, that you could go on lysine as a way of helping prevent that virus from activating in your brain? There might be some evidence there. The Mediterranean diet emphasizes many things, but foods that are naturally high in lysine as well, including fish. And most of the benefits for from fish being attributed to omega-3s, but also fish has one of the most naturally higher occurring ratios of lysine to arginine. And that indeed might be one of its main benefits in terms of dealing and helping the body is actually that, not just the omega-3s. So, now, we've looked at infectious diseases and vitamin D, and especially the interrelation between those. We're also looking at the role of obesity and insulin resistance. Type 2 diabetes, elevations of blood sugar, is usually, now again, related to the standard American diet, okay, standard American lifestyle. So, on the website, I have a basic nutritional protocol, I have my foundations of health, and relate most disease to, and most dysfunction, most lack of optimal wellness to, too much stress, our diet, standard American diet, lack of exercise, okay? Because every one of those things can prevent the progression of Alzheimer's, and furthermore, optimize memory function, and there's a gob of research on this. It's way more than I could cover. One of the ways that it does that is by treating insulin resistance. And this is a study taking people, insulin resistance and cognitive impairment, archives in neurology, look at basic things, plasma insulin, insulin resistance, insulin sensitivity, on older people. This was the prevalence of insulin resistance in that population, and basically in the normal population versus the cognitive impaired, look at the difference. Huge, higher level of insulin resistance, which doesn't prove causation, just proves an association. Did a 15-year study, okay, look at dementia onset, and this is glucose tolerance in the community, different study, sorry. And basically what you can look at is, this is normal subjects, impaired glucose tolerance or insulin resistance, and diabetes. And you notice a direct correlation, and most of the problems that are associated with all-cause dementia and Alzheimer's disease even happens just at the insulin resistance level. It's a greater risk as you go from here to here than even when you go from impaired glucose tolerance to diabetes. And this is looking at vascular dementia as well, which of course would correlate directly with this insulin resistance syndrome. Yes? Dementia is a group of disorders that are associated with memory loss. Okay, the subclassifications of dementias include Alzheimer's type, which is stereotypical with these amyloid plaques and things, whereas vascular dementia is classically the multi-infarct dementia with many, many strokes. Okay, Parkinson's dementia is Parkinson's disease and subsequent problems in the brain, and the other forms have their own pathology. So there's many types of dementia. The one that most people have heard about is Alzheimer's, and I think most people have heard of vascular dementia related basically to hardening of the arteries and that kind of stuff. So, very important. Are these people... the relative risk of developing Alzheimer's with diabetes is almost twofold higher, and really have got to hear this, okay? Insulin resistance is a disease. Your doctor gives you more insulin to make your insulin resistance worse and subsequently makes you have much more Alzheimer's disease. Insulin as a treatment for type 2 diabetes is a cause of heart attack, stroke, early mortality, and Alzheimer's. It's one of the primary things many people get for their type 2 diabetes, despite the fact that it's known the insulin. So the problem to recognize isn't just blood sugar, because we're going to talk about blood sugar in a second. Okay, natural levels of blood sugar being low are good, but once you start treating with insulin, making the underlying disease worse, this is so important for you to understand. If insulin resistance and too much insulin is a problem, you can pound people with insulin, lower their blood sugar, I win. No, you don't. You cause Alzheimer's disease. You cause cancer. You cause heart attacks and stroke. So if you know anybody who's taking insulin for their diabetes, they have to do absolutely everything to not take insulin to control their diabetes, because type 2 diabetes. Type 1 is insulin deficient. They can't live without, okay, any insulin. Type 2s, most people make this mistake, by the way. If a type 2 is taking insulin, they don't have insulin-dependent diabetes. They're usually mistreated with insulin to lower their blood sugar, causing greater disease, okay, because we mistake and we think the blood sugar is the end-all be-all. The blood sugar needs to be treated, but we need to treat the reason that the blood sugar is elevated, people. Okay, once again, thinking, okay? That's the important part of this. So we have to think, you know, what am I supposed to do when my doctor says I'm supposed to take insulin for my type 2 diabetes? Find someone who knows better. That's what you need. I'm not kidding. It's your life, okay? Yes? Metformin is a medicine that improves insulin resistance, and you know, even the Life Extension Group looks at it as an anti-aging medicine, but I think that's taking a little far. But metformin is one of the medicines that's okay to treat type 2 diabetes because it actually improves insulin resistance while lowering blood sugar. I'm not saying blow off blood sugar, by the way. I'm saying we need to get that blood sugar down, but we also need to get the insulin levels down too. So as you can imagine, you lower blood sugar, but you make the underlying disease, insulin resistance, that much worse. A whole host of inflammatory mediators are going on, not only unabated, but worsened by your treatment. That's why you cause Alzheimer's disease by treating in a way that promotes the disease and doesn't just treat the symptom or the sign, treats the underlying disease as well. Advanced glycation end products. It's interesting, they're called age. One of the theories of aging is advanced glycation end products, okay? And this basically, and we'll talk about this, there's receptors for age called RAGE. So when you actually are aging your brain, you've got RAGE in the brain, okay? This is probably the most important slide of this talk. I want you to hear this, because I can show this same chart not only just for your annual brain volume, but your risk for heart attack, stroke, and pretty much cancer, and it goes on and on. So, two take-home things in terms of analysis. Get your vitamin D level and make sure it's between 70 and 90. Anybody who tells you not to get it there doesn't understand what they're doing and is promoting disease in you, okay, whether they know it or not, okay? Second, get your hemoglobin A1C. Hemoglobin A1C is glycohemoglobin. It's sugar glommed onto your hemoglobin. It's an advanced glycation end product, okay? Hemoglobin A1C, and these are perfect numbers. This is diabetes, okay? And this is different levels of insulin resistance. Remember that earlier chart where most of the risk for Alzheimer's came at insulin resistance. It comes at this level. This is a level that most doctors don't even talk about because you're not diabetic yet. Well, what can you do? Well, this is the most dangerous level. And furthermore, if you see, just go from a normal A1C less than 5.2, please remember that number, and just get to this level here. And why is this number here so clumped together? Because as you get worse, the brain atrophy is not changing that much. This is the percent annual brain volume change. And unfortunately, yes, your brain is shrinking every year. Sorry. But to a much double the rate if your number is out here than over here. Double the rate of brain atrophy every moment of every day if your A1C is too high. So is blood sugar relevant? Yes. If your blood sugar is high and you have advanced glycation end products, you will have a more rapid aging brain. And anything you can do through meditative practice, stress reduction, regular exercise, whole food nutrition, which we'll talk about in a second, and sometimes multiple nutrients and whatever else it takes to get your blood sugar in the optimal range through treating your body, treating insulin resistance, and then treating the blood sugar. Okay?
What's the optimal blood sugar?
An A1C. So this goes into a fasting plasma glucose less than 85. Okay, so the answer to the question is in terms of blood sugar. This number is different, is related directly to your plasma glucose, your fasting, and your postprandial, sorry, your after-meal blood sugars. But basically correlates with a fasting plasma glucose of less than 85, and probably 75 and under is considered optimal. Fasting blood sugar is reliable, because if you're in a rush to get the lab that morning, your blood sugar can go up. You had a bad night, your blood sugar can go up. The A1C is a 3-month average of your blood sugar, so it's a much more reliable test. So that's why we don't use the fasting glucose that much.
But it's the same level.
It's based upon the blood sugar, exactly. You're measuring a 3-month blood sugar, basically. It's a little more complicated than that. That's basically what you're measuring. You want to be about under 5.2, long and short of it. There doesn't seem to be much benefit from getting much lower, okay? These advanced glycation end products cause modulation of beta amyloid. We want to get to some other things. Upregulation of cyclooxygenase 2, that's the COX inhibitors, most of us heard of those, and how they might help with prevention of Alzheimer's, depending on some things. These things can be treated by many things, many nutrients, including resveratrol. There's one quick slide here. This is I love this. Terostilbene is the latest, greatest resveratrol. It's a metabolite of resveratrol. Now, and this study is the one that got it all the rage on terostilbene, okay? I want to emphasize is that this is looking at a mouse model of Alzheimer's, okay? And if one thing I've ever known about resveratrol, if I was a mouse, I would be taking the stuff, okay? And if I read this study and I was a mouse, I'd be taking terostilbene too, because I would be ruling, okay? However, we've yet to find a direct correlation between resveratrol and mice and terostilbene in mice. So I'm not yet jumping on the terostilbene bandwagon. I might be wrong. I want to emphasize that. I'm actually relatively conservative when it comes to supplements. I don't always jump on the latest one, and sometimes I'm wrong about that, okay? But I have no problem with terostilbene, but it might be better in terms of helping with this NRF2 activation, which we'll get to. We can prevent the majority of Alzheimer's by working on the basics, quitting smoking, more mental activity, learn another language, challenge yourself. You have to use your brain in different ways, play a new instrument, find different ways of challenging your brain. That's the best way to keep your memory going. Exercising, a better way than taking supplements of keeping your memory going. Diet, I can go on and on, okay? So I can emphasize, everybody here knows I love supplements, okay? So I'm not going to say different. But supplements are great if you do the other things. They don't do a whole heck of a lot if you're eating Twinkies, okay? This is a typical thing about, this is a drug slide, and I just put this up here because, you know, this is the kind of thing that the doctor gets. Oh, take this, and you're going to be really helping your patients. What do the journals say? The journal shows that there's no effect in mild Alzheimer's and that the medicines we prescribe absolutely unequivocally don't work. That's what it shows, okay? So off-label use of Namenda, the Aricepts of the world and the other things that are being used have a tiny little effect, almost no effect on activities of daily living. That's the primary thing the neurologists give today. And why, once again, You look at that whole model, the far right giving you acetylcholinesterase inhibitors, boosting acetylcholine levels will do this tiny little bit and miss the entire disease. Sort of like giving insulin when you don't have just a low blood sugar instead of lowering blood sugar and doing it in a way that treats the underlying disease. So this is, you know, any number of things. This is the pharmaceutical industry. This is your doctor. This is you. This is your doctor, and this is you. I can do anything like this. This is one of my favorite far slides. NRF2, let's just leave this, you know, because we got to get to the end of things, and I want to, you know, I know, can see you guys are just like, bleh. This is a technical talk. I understand that, okay? It's on the website. But there's almost no way of doing justice to this thing and just saying, gosh, I want you to meditate more. Everybody here knows I want you to meditate more, okay? And is that one of the key ways that you can decrease inflammation in the brain? And there's a gob of studies, yes. But most people don't listen to that, as it turns out. And they don't listen to just saying to exercise. They think it's not scientific. What I'm telling you is the least scientific thing you can do is not take vitamin D. The least scientific thing you can do is when it comes to treating diabetes in a certain way, taking Namenda, taking Aricept, all the things that are done in Western medicine today for this entity are against everything science tells us to do. And I'll let you come to what conclusions why that is. This funny thing right here, and unfortunately this is one of Dr. Perlmutter's slides. And this is things that activate. NRF2 is one of the great enzymes in your body that activates one of your, more so than glutathione reductase, more so than anything else, helps your body regulate antioxidant and anti-inflammatory activities. NRF2, just remember NRF2. It is the enzyme of our day, okay? NRF2 is important for helping things, okay? Now, and helping almost everything. Muscular health, brain health, kidney health. It's one of the best enzyme systems to know about in terms of what to activate so that you can protect your health. This slide goes over natural extracts, turmeric being one of the most powerful ones. This thing, if you play his button, this guy is bending and bowing in front of coffee, because when you do the final slide and put coffee up here, he has to go through here, puts a break, and comes out through here. Coffee is the greatest activator of NRF2 ever studied, and it's about 3 to 4 times the level of any other extract known, and including caffeinated coffee, but coffee as well, because coffee is one of the best herbal blends ever. Okay, we just did a review in New England Journal of Medicine, just put out there in the New England Journal of Medicine. You can prevent pretty much every form of early death, with the exception of cancer, with coffee. But from everything, from heart attacks and cancers, and you know, when it goes into the accidents, it goes on and on and on. Yes? Bye. So great question, but this, and look at the genesis of the question. Well, but what about all those bad things I've heard about it? Doesn't it hurt my adrenals? Doesn't it dehydrate me? Doesn't it bad for my bones? I want to believe how bad coffee is because everybody tells it to me. I want to. And I know I'm taking it a little further, but that's what happens when all the evidence, epidemiological speaking, shows that coffee is one of the healthiest beverages around. Okay. And it's the most healthy thing. It's the most NRF2 activating. I could go on and on about the mechanisms by which coffee actually treats disease. Now, if you have adrenal dysfunction, that needs to be treated. And if you just treat it with coffee to try to make yourself go, adrenal fatigue is a whole other subject, okay? And just treat it with coffee, I think you're doing a disservice to your body. But does coffee itself cause adrenal dysfunction? There's never been an evidence of it. It isn't a good treatment for it, though, however, okay? People who you overdose coffee, and it's a very interesting thing. Most of the studies on coffee show the more you drink, the less diabetes and the less just about everything. And there's almost no upper limits on how much more is being better, by the way. But listen to your body. So once again, I drink coffee and I feel bad. Don't drink it. Okay? Seriously. I mean, you don't take data like this and say, I'm going to start drinking coffee if I feel bad. No, you want to listen to your body, because most likely that's your body's way of saying coffee's not good for you. Okay? I mean, I cannot emphasize this enough. And so, but it's profoundly NRF2 activating, and nothing is even close. Yes? It will be on the website, but turmeric, rosemary, broccoli, thyme, clove all have mild NRF2 activating. These are some other herbal extracts as well. But turmeric, if you look at an herbal extract that has the most evidence, it's turmeric outside of coffee. In the trials, most of the coffee say an optimal dosage of coffee is somewhere around 5 cups per day. and that's in long-term health, not just for brain health. That's in terms of cardiovascular health, almost every prevention of almost every known cause of mortality. And most of the bigger trials, for whatever reason, because coffee has a great effect against preventing liver cancer in alcoholics and in Hep C, but it doesn't have an overall effect against cancer. Yes, who? You know, I did some research on that. I just to show, because I heard funny thing. So I was really doing some research on coffee recently and looking through some of this, because, you know, I understand that if I was a really better coffee drinker, I'd be using lighter roasts and because it's more refined and all this other stuff. As it turns out, the darker roasts have the higher levels of the active caffeic acids and things. So darker roast coffee seem to be by far better, which is, yes, leads you more towards the Starbucks and types of things than the Folgers of the world. So there you go. I think organic, drink, live as organic as possible, okay? And I would do that long before I had the scientific evidence to do that, because most likely you're never going to get the scientific evidence to do that, okay? So this is like anything else. Are you ever really going to get a double-blind placebo-controlled trial on a Mediterranean diet? No, because the person knows what they're eating, which goes into, well, the doctor therefore can't prescribe it because there's no double-blind trials, which doesn't make any sense at all, okay? But that's what happens. Hyperbaric oxygen, another wonderful thing, used to treat almost everything. I'm just going to run through a few slides. Hyperbaric oxygen is used to treat almost all the neurodegenerative disorders. Increasing oxygen levels has a profound anti-inflammatory effect on the brain. It's used for a lot of things. This guy, David Perlmutter, uses hyperbaric oxygen. That's his office, okay? He uses it for a lot of things. Calorie restriction is wonderful in improving memory. And there's many mechanisms of that. I'm going to go through a few of these slides. Most people won't do calorie restriction. So it's one of those impractical things, but it's been shown if you decrease 30% above your baseline calorie consumption, almost everybody's memory will improve. Okay, just cutting out calories, even the organic kind. But they're organic calories. Sorry, that's some, you know. There's still something to do with calorie restriction. One of the things, French paradox. French eat more saturated fats than almost any Western country that has saturated fats. The incidence of heart-related death among middle-aged men is less than half that of Americans. The lowest rate is Gascony, the area with the highest fat consumption. This is saturated fats. The Indian paradox. People in northern India eat 17 times more animal fat compared to the south and have 1/7 the rate of heart disease. Next slide. The diet-heart hypothesis, suggesting that fat and cholesterol cause, has been repeatedly shown to be wrong by the Framingham guy where they use the data from, okay? For complicated reasons of pride, profit, prejudice, the hypothesis continues to be exploited by scientists, fundraising enterprises, food companies, and even governmental agencies. The public is being deceived by the greatest health scam of the century. Anybody trying to eat low fat has no idea what they're doing. Sorry. That's a perpetrated myth upon you. Okay? It's absolutely unequivocally wrong, according to every study. Okay? There's a lot of reasons why it came to the being, because more or less, because egg yolks look like atherosclerotic plaques, more or less, okay? but just a lot more complicated. The egg yolk didn't go directly to your artery. The biggest problem, especially everybody knows this, the obesity epidemic, all rates of chronic disease went sky high as we went to low-fat foods, because we started eating more and more carbs as carbohydrates, which is the cause of insulin resistance, obesity, and death. Okay. And so, please, if you even think of eating low fat, remember this moment. It's a perpetrated myth. Okay. Diet and Alzheimer's disease. More or less, this is a whole set of slides showing, and I'm looking at things that comes from May of 2011, showing that the Mediterranean diet, and I'm going to run through these slides because they're all on there, are associated, we'll get to this slide here, adherence to the Mediterranean diet not only affects the risk of Alzheimer's disease, but pre-dementia, okay, and prevents the progression to overt dementia. And there's a whole lot of reasons for this, but high levels of consumptions of fats from fish and vegetable oils, non-starchy vegetables, low glycemic index fruits, low in added sugars. Nothing here is mentioning trying to eat low fat. And so, I'll get to gluten in a bit. Can you show them the next month's talk?
I'm going to talk about glutens. Glutens have kind of taken over, and we're going to talk about glutens and gluten sensitivity, celiacs, and a bunch of other things next time. But there is a strong association between gluten sensitivity and microvascular damage in the brain and all kinds of other things. Yes. Salt is primarily related to blood pressure, and salt is primarily, if you actually go back and look at the data, it's all processed foods that are associated with higher risk of heart disease, and salt is present in processed foods. So it depends on how you manipulate the data, okay, because is it the salt or is it the sugars? And the answer is yes, probably. People are usually eating way too much salt. But is salt a primary perpetrator in this? Probably not. But salt is directly, consumption is directly related to all the processed foods that we don't want people eating. So that's why it's tough to weed that out. Okay? Yes? The question is there a difference between sea salt and other forms of salt? Possibly. Okay? There's not enough real data to back that up. All right. This is a paleo. Everybody's hearing these paleo diets, kind of eating in the past. This is much closer to the reality of a food pyramid. Eat more of the healthy fats. If you do eat meats, eat grass-fed, pasture-fed, healthy fish and eggs. So organic, organic, organic. Grass-fed, grass-fed, grass-fed if you eat ruminants. On starchy vegetables, really, the question is all grains and legumes and sugars are the biggest thing to be avoiding in our diet. They're the thing associated with chronic disease. That's the biggest message behind this. Physical activity profoundly affects... Basically, in this study of adults, there was a six month of exercise led to an 18 month difference in the rate of progression of Alzheimer's disease. Long and short of it, exercise can treat Alzheimer's disease as well as prevent it. 142 exercise minutes of exercise per week led to a modest improvement in cognition related to older adults, and basically the other ones who didn't exercise had a decline. Walking slows the progression of Alzheimer's. In this study, walking 6 miles a week, instead of the mini mental status exam declining by 5 points, okay, it declined only by 1 point. So many of these things, if you try to isolate interventions and say, the only thing I'm going to do for my Alzheimer's is exercise, you're missing all the other problems. But exercise is one of the interventions to do, along with vitamin D, along with healthy fats. DHA, the most profoundly important omega-3 fatty acids, normalizing brain-derived neurotrophic factor. This is a relative risk of Alzheimer's disease based upon quintiles of intake of DHA. The higher the levels, this is the top fifth in terms of people and the amount of DHA in their diet, and it goes directly and linearly down. So everybody knows I have this basic nutritional protocol. If you're breathing, you take a good multi, and I have a whole talk on what a good multi is, fish oils, and vitamin D. Most chronic diseases, you can profoundly benefit by doing that, along with exercise and meditation. It goes on and on. Boost memory for healthy adults. There's lots of studies on that. Plays a pivotal role in so many areas in terms of neuronal membrane fluidity. That's probably its biggest role. You are what you eat. You eat sticky fats, you get sticky brain. Okay? You eat fluid fats, you have a fluid brain. And that one actually is relatively simple. Probiotics. Probiotics play more of a role than you would ever have an idea in terms of your absorption and utilization of neurotransmitters from the bacteria in your intestinal tract to insulin resistance to glucose control. It goes on and on and on. And so probiotics are another thing to strongly consider. We have a very significant amount of gastrointestinal diseases that go unrecognized. And the imbalance of the flora in your intestinal tract, this is its talk in and of itself. You have 10 times as many organisms in your intestinal tract as you have cells. They're living and dying and breathing, creating stuff, and you're absorbing their stuff, okay? So you do feel like shit, okay? It's not a figurative statement. You feel like it. So should you have healthy poop? Yes, okay? So you're spending time helping, seriously, taking care of your poop health is as important as taking care of your liver or your kidneys or any other organ system. It's that profound. And it has a profound effect on psychiatric stability, neuronal health, and goes on and on. We're going to do brief things. Gluten sensitivity, that's a whole talk in and of itself. You have to understand when you do a talk like this because there's so many areas. I said it was a multi-week symposium. I could seriously talk for weeks on this, okay? So, and then dive into each one of these subjects. My job in a talk like this is to start making you informed and then start looking, okay? Gluten sensitivity may be present in 30 to 40% of the population. And I want to be at 30 to 40% of the population, all right? And it's not celiac disease. Most of your times, your doctor tests you for celiac disease, and you don't have that, and they good. They ruled out the 0.1% of people who have actual gluten sensitivity issues because it's a different problem. Celiac disease is an autoimmune disease associated, triggered by the gluten protein, and there's a whole subset of conditions called gluten sensitivity syndromes. That's another subject. Alcohol consumption. There is hope. Finally, something I can do. All right, I can do coffee. Most of you can. So this took a 3-year follow-up and took primary care attendees of 75 years of age and older. So this is really important to understand. This, they took 75-year-olds and said, huh, what's the effect of alcohol on the brain? Okay, and they prospectively evaluated it. And they took in Germany, which obviously they had, that was like 50% were drinking, which is, you know, yay. and looked at 1.5 years and 3 years later, okay, and all alcohol consumption of any kind, okay, led to a decreased risk in Alzheimer's and dementia. And those rates, so in within a 3-year period, this led to a more profound treatment of and prevention of cognitive impairment and progression of Alzheimer's by far than taking Namenda. Okay? Uh-huh. And not even close, because Namenda doesn't work. That was easy, okay? And so it's so funny, because most people keep on hearing alcohol is bad for your brain, alcohol is bad for your brain. And the answer is no, because of the mechanism at the very beginning of the talk, prevention of the glutamate excitotoxicity, low-dose alcohol, one drink a day for women, up to 2 drinks a day in guys, is associated with profound benefits in terms of prevention of dementia. Profound. Even in 75-year-olds. Yes? There is a study showing that smokers might have a lower rate of Parkinson's. But no, I'm not going to tell you to start smoking. But this is very interesting. One of the first things, if you go to any of the Trudeau's and all the prescriptions of nutritional healing, the first thing, oh, if you have this condition, stop smoking, which I agree with. Stop drinking alcohol. Stop, you know, caffeine. It does all your coffee and all these things. There is zero evidence behind those recommendations. If you actually look scientifically. Now, once again, in moderation, everybody knows a friend who's an alcoholic and one beer always leads to 12. Okay. They need to not drink. Okay, seriously, that makes, you know, of course, common sense. We're not talking about drinking and driving. We're not talking about fetal alcohol syndrome. We're talking about, in the appropriate dosages, alcohol is one of the most preventive things in terms of heart attack and stroke, and in terms of prevention of mild cognitive impairment and dementia. Yes? Alcohol has not been shown to make blood sugar problems worse. It actually protects diabetics probably more than it does non-diabetics. And that's another thing. Like anything else, we're not saying a whole bottle of wine is good for you. Okay? And this is really important here. Yes? There is some evidence that red wine is better for the brain. There is some. I'm going to have to admit that. But this German trial was all alcohol. You are correct. Okay? This is another health benefits of wine alcohol for neuroprotection to heart health. And it goes on into looking at all these studies showing almost all neurodegenerative disorders have a decreased rate in people who drink versus those who don't drink. It goes on and on. Alcohol present in wine may have some polyphenols present that are present in red wine, may play some additive benefits. That's tough to tease out some of these things in some of these trials, just so you understand. It's unequivocal. Alcohol and heart disease, all forms of alcohol exactly equal. So when it comes to prevention of heart attack, 1 ounce of hard alcohol versus 5 ounces of wine versus 12 ounces of beer, which is a drink, okay, is exactly equal, about a 40% decreased risk in heart attack and stroke versus non-drinkers, okay. When it comes to prevention of progression of dementia and things like that, there might be some benefit to red wine you don't see with those other forms of alcohol. So this is the model, and I'm going to do this anyways. I'm sure I'm going to lose a few of you right now, but I'm going to do this anyhow. So, low-effort thought promotes political conservatism. They've actually have studies showing, so I'm trying to figure out, what is the thing behind things? They actually show that the more you, if you get become intoxicated, you become more conservative. If you get put under stress, you become more conservative. If you are participating in any terms, and if you are actually, I don't want to look at this. I want you to read this together, folks. Together, these data suggest that the political conservatism may be a process consequence of low effort thought. When effortful, deliberate thought is disengaged, you become a conservative. Actually, all the studies prove that. And I want to point out, all the things trying to get you not take vitamin D, pro-inflammatory in the brain, all the you know, whatever, Santorum, trying to get you not be educated, all those efforts to keep you from thinking are to keep you conservative. That's what the data shows. So, on that note, any other questions? Yes. Yes, and when I say it that way, if your person says, I don't think I'm doing well with coffee. This is your own intuition. Okay, I really want to emphasize that. And your intuition is, I think I like tea better, and you feel better with tea. Please listen to that. Don't use this data to go for it. But if you stop coffee because you heard it was bad, you have dramatically increased your all-cause mortality from every known kind of things, increased your risk for progression to dementia and to everything else. So hearing, that's exactly what I'm talking about. If hearing it's bad is the exact thing I'm trying to get you past, because that's back to this puritanical conservative movement, which anything that feels good has to be bad for you. That's what we're being taught. And it's not true. Okay, things that can feel good actually can be good for you too. I'm not saying they're all, okay, but that's what you have to understand. There's a movement to get you to believe things that actually aren't true, and they're not driven by science, and your doctors are not driven by science. It's very fascinating. Yes? Yeah. According to some trials, decaf is as good and other trials not. Caffeine itself has an additive effect. There's some really great trials on this, looking at this NRF2 activation, and definitely the polyphenols present within coffee actually have a very NRF2 activating, but you add in the caffeine back, if the caffeine was taken out, it adds another 20 or 30% benefit. So the caffeinated coffee in most trials actually has more benefit than decaf. There is some benefit to decaf as well, though. Yes? That's another good myth. So krill oil. Krill oil is one of the things, and it's another one of those supplements that cycles back and forth, okay? So I've been doing this a long time. So krill oil came out 10, 12 years ago, and it was supposed to be great for cholesterol, PMS, and arthritis, I think it was. It doesn't matter because it isn't good for any of those things. Why do I forget it? Because it's not, okay? And the fact of the matter is that when it came back, cycled back another 10 to 12 years later, it still wasn't any better. What I would point out to you is that krill oil, krill has some beneficial fatty acids that aren't EPA and DHA. What's happening is you're asking the either or question, okay, which is the worst possible result. There is millions upon millions of people who've been studied with EPA and DHA, benefits that are so profound, so overwhelming. And people trying to get into that market through as many mechanisms as they can, and they're using krill oil as one of those ways, and saying you don't need to take fish oil, and that's 100% inaccurate. If you say, and I had a lady the other day, she felt that her joints got better when she took this one other supplement, doesn't matter, a collagen-type supplement, and krill oil. And I said, great, keep taking your collagen supplement and your krill oil if you feel like your joints are better. I have zero against that. I do not think krill oil is dangerous, unless, which she did do, she stopped taking her fish oils, which dramatically increased her risk of Alzheimer's, dementias, and all those other types of things. Krill oil is an add-on for treatment of certain things. There is not enough evidence there prospectively, and I can't emphasize, to come close to EPA and DHA, the good fish oils. So if you experiment with krill oil, it's not an either or. That's the way it's being sold, because they're trying to get your money and spending, and seriously, the money people are spending for that krill oil, that stuff, it's so expensive. It's such a ruse, okay? That's what kind of gets me about that one. There's so many supplements like that without any really good data to have it recirculate like it did. There's a couple of meaningless studies out there that people point to, and I've read them. So if you feel better with krill oil, that's the way to experiment with it, and I want to use it for my PMS, which I'm not guessing you have, but maybe arthritis, then try it for a few months and see if you feel better. There's zero problems that I have with that. But don't, it does not substitute for fish oils, and that's one of the great lies. Yes?
How much fish oil should you take?
Fish oil. First of all, supplements. If you buy supplements, you buy quality supplements like the kinds you see here, okay, or you buy nothing at all. If cost is your main issue when it comes to buying a supplement, save yourself the most money and buy nothing. Most fish oils out there are rancid fat pellets of death, okay? They are horrific. They really have turned bad, and if you even bit into your capsule, you would be horrified at what you're thinking you're taking to be healthy, okay? So number one is quality. So on the website, we have things. Carlson, Nordic Naturals, there's many good companies like the kinds you can find here, okay? And the dosage of a good fish oil, the EPA plus DHA total should be somewhere around 2,500 milligrams a day. That's the optimal dosage. That's like a tablespoon a day of good fish oil and about 3 to 4 capsules of a good quality fish oil. But you need to look at the bottle and say, if this one capsule has how much EPA and how much DHA. Another thing, 10 years ago, everything was being concentrated to EPA because it was the good fish oil. Now everybody's concentrating to DHA because it's the good one. Avoid the pendulum. Truth is in the middle. EPA is good. DHA is good. Stay in the middle. There's reasons to use high doses of one or the other for certain conditions. That's not the realm of a public talk, okay? So, and that standard ratio, 3 to 2 of EPA of DHA is pretty good, okay? So 2,500 milligrams a day of EPA and DHA combined. Now, the reason I say that, sometimes a fish oil, you have to look at the bottle. Like 2 fish oil capsules will have 2,000 milligrams of fish oil, but you look at the 2 capsules only have a total of 500 of EPA and DHA. And you think, well, I'm taking 2,000 milligrams, that's good, right? I go, no, you need 10 capsules to get to the 2,500. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay, so that's a really important concept is you look at the dosage to make sure you're not getting, and you don't need to, you know, it's like these Udos balance with 6s and 9s. Every American is overloaded with 6s and 9s, and they're getting these stupid fish, these capsules that you get very little omega-3s, and they throw in all the fats you don't need, and you think you're getting a balanced fat. It's craziness. You need EPA and DHA. That's the good ones. Flax oil is not the same thing. Flax has its own things. ALA and flax and those things have some benefits. It's EPA and DHA that have human benefit, just like D3 is for humans, okay? And that's the audience today. Yes. Whether krill oil is really more sustainable is a whole battle in and of itself, and the fish eat the algae that processing to EPA and DHA better than eating krill oil? Probably, okay. And being a vegetarian is a wonderful thing. This is one area that you're going to miss out on, is unless you love genetically modified tomatoes, which have DHA popping out of them, which I think is just still kind of weird. And that's completely non-doctor at that moment, by the way. Just the thought of DHA popping out of tomatoes seems just weird to me, okay? Because you can't find DHA out of tomatoes in nature. So it's genetic. I have this gut thing about genetically modified food that just makes me nervous. And that's not scientific. And that's okay for me to do. I don't ask other people to have the same beliefs that I do in that area. But there's something odd about genetically modified food and DHA coming from tomatoes, just so I can be a vegetarian. That feels freaky to me.
But the legumes and legumes, you're
talking
about that.
Legumes have some benefits in general. And so, but that's a whole other subject. So.
Okay.
Yes.
Sugar
is the toxin of our day. I mean, that's the whole thing. And so, you know, we really got, because that's the thing, the gluten-free, you know, when we talk about that, there's such a movement now to get gluten-free cookies and gluten-free pastas, and everybody's eating, they're still getting these super high-carb diet, and I still see a lot of danger in that as well, too. So the main toxin of today is processed foods. Eat a fresh, organic, whole, and if there's any take-home message in diet, as organic as possible, as fresh and whole food as possible. And don't listen to Gary, don't listen to Dr. Oz, don't listen to T. Colin Campbell, don't listen to any of those people. Listen to yourself. You have had your health stripped away from you because you believe you need to talk to somebody else about how to eat. And that has been a problem because your doctor sold you low-fat diets. We sold you margarine. We sold you just about everything, and you bought it, okay? And that's the key word, bought it, okay? Now, what does that mean? If I eat blueberries and I feel bad, I don't eat blueberries. Most people can tell that I love blueberries. I think they're great. But if they don't do well in your body, don't eat them. This whole thing, do we have to eat, you know, vegetarian? If you feel better when you eat vegetarian, you should eat vegetarian. And if you feel worse, then you probably ought to reconsider it. I mean, that's just, to me, common sense, you know. And so on that order. We've disempowered ourselves, okay? Really, we're giving over our locus of control for our health to these doctor types. And that our training is to help guide you. Doctor means to teach, right? That's the root word, doctor means to teach. So doctors are supposed to teach you to take care of yourself. We're not supposed to give you drugs for your symptoms. But that's what we've become. Kind of sad. And so when it comes to this diet thing, get some information, but like stop and coffee because it's bad. Ooh, the data's not there. Eating a low-fat diet, ooh, that's horrible. Because it's not supported by data. Unless you feel great when you cut out fats out of your diet. That's something to pay attention to. Most people, if they cut out, even especially the good fats, you will have sticky, unhealthy cells because you need fats to live. So that's part of the mythology. Do we need to avoid corn-fed beef? Yes, because the fatty acid profile is horrible. But you know what's worse? Farm-raised tilapia has a worse profile in fatty acids than the corn-fed beef. And most people are out there eating tilapia like it's supposed to be healthy for them. It's not. Okay? So, again, wild-caught salmon. We can get that in our ear. Farm-raised, grass-fed, hormone-free, as organic as possible beef. I know that's difficult and pricey, but guess what that'll end up doing? Calorie restriction. Finances will force you into calorie restriction. So there's a benefit to that. So eat less of the really good grass-fed beef, okay? There are many Mediterranean guides. I don't know the name of one off the top of my head. But if you Google that and look through things, I recommend going through Amazon, pulling up things and reading through the reviews and going through those things. That's the best way to look and see what appeals to you. There's many ways. And again, get cookbooks because you need recipes and things. And we have nutritionists we work with and things like that. Because when it comes to the rubber hitting the road, you need to clean out your cabinets. You need to change the way you shop and everything else. And that'll make the biggest difference. And I hope you're getting this, by the way. The way to optimize mental performance, very simple things, okay? Regular exercise, stress reduction, whole food diet, certain things like getting fish oils and vitamin D, looking and measuring certain things like my vitamin D level and my A1C. If they're not optimized, I know that I'm not there yet, and I need to keep working on it without guilt, blame, and shame, okay? And so you'll have profound ways of improving mental performance. You cut out sugar, and you do a detox from that, and you cut out all processed carbs, 2 weeks later, you will feel better. Almost always. Okay?
What about ginkgo biloba?
Rocky Balboa. Ginkgo Balboa. No, just kidding. Ginkgo biloba. I just like the whole Rocky poorly. Anyways.
Adrian!
Ginkgo biloba is what the real question was about. And ginkgo biloba actually has been shown to help with mild cognitive impairment, and it does have some benefits on top of doing these things. So most of the trials of mild cognitive impairment, but where it really didn't work well was in people who had moderate and Alzheimer's. That's not good enough for that because you have a more severe disease, but in mild cognitive impairment, ginkgo biloba actually has a significant effect in terms of improving memory. So ginkgo biloba is a useful herbal supplement. And there's a million herbal supplements that can be useful. And there's a lot of supplements that can be useful. That wasn't, my son works in the store, was asking, are we going to talk about certain supplements and is there anything we should know about? And I'm like, I really avoided supplements today because I don't want people, because that's the other thing, I'm trying to get people away. They come to this integrative doctor and the model today is, well, I don't want to take a drug, but I don't want to exercise. I don't want to eat right. Can I have some herb to take instead of my drug? And you're missing the point. That's not my job. Substituting a supplement instead of a drug isn't being integrative. It's just doing something else that's, missing the point. In general, would I rather use supplements than drugs? Well, of course. But, it takes more than that if you want healing. Because drugs are there for the person who doesn't want to do anything and just take a drug and hope it deals at least with the symptom or sign. And I'm not saying that's always wrong, by the way. There's a time and place for medicines. Thank heavens for drugs and surgery when you need them. You'll never hear me say different. They are awesome. Okay. It's just that when they're so awesome at certain times, we use them when we don't need them. Any other questions?
What's your opinion about the Life Extension supplements?
Life Extension is a good company. They've gone along towards, their magazine or what they call the Journal of Life Extension, which is, a full advertisement for the stuff they do. And they have some decent stuff, and they have some not so good stuff too. So it's like a lot of things though. So anyways, thank you very much for going to get home and